trying to keep her voice casual. Mingus glanced at the balaclava, then at her, eyes widening.
Of course I do. He's an archaeologist. Something to do with Orca. Orkney Research Centre, I mean.
Orkney?
You're no telling me he was with the people who...
Pretty sure. I saw his face for just a second when I pulled this off him, and... She grimaced in distaste, plucking a tuft of sandy hair from inside of the balaclava. Apparently, that's not all I pulled off him. Rob knows him. He came out to Lallybroch to give us an opinion on some ruins up behind the house, and stayed to supper.
Oh, deary me, Mingus murmured, seeming to sink back into his seat.
He took off his glasses and massaged his forehead for a bit. She watched him think, feeling increasingly remote.
The waitress hove to and put down a fresh cup of hot, milky tea, already sugared and stirred. Brianna thanked her and sat sipping it, watching the night outside. Annie had taken Jem off in the direction of the garage, doubtless to check on his van.
"I can see why you don't want trouble," Mingus said carefully at last.
He'd eaten half his butty. The rest of it lay on the plate, oozing ketchup in a queasy sort of way.
"But really, Mrs... May I call you Brianna?"
"Bree," she said. "Sure."
"Bree," he said, nodding,
and one corner of his mouth twitched. "Yes, I know what it means in Scots," she said dryly, seeing the thought cross his face. A bree was a storm, or a great disturbance.
Lionel's face broke into a half-smile.
"Yes. Well, what I'm thinking, Bree... I hate to suggest it, but what if Rob's done some harm to Roger? Would it not be worth the questions to get the police to look for him?"
"He hasn't." She felt unutterably tired and wanted only to go home. "Believe me, he hasn't. Roger went with his cousin Buck. And if Rob had managed to hurt them somehow, he'd certainly have gloated about that when he... Well..."
She took a breath that went all the way down to her aching feet and shifted her weight, getting a solid hold on Mandy.
"Lionel, tell you what. Drive us home, will you? If that lot's still lurking around, then we'll go to the police right away. If not, it can wait till the morning."
He didn't like it, but he was suffering from the after-effects of shock and fatigue, too, and after more argument finally agreed, done in by her implacable stubbornness. Ernie had telephoned for a ride after being assured that Lionel would see them home. Lionel was tense on the way back to Lallybroch, hands white-knuckled on the steering wheel, but the Fiat's headlights showed the dooryard empty, save for a discarded tyre lying in the gravel, shredded rubber spraying out like the wings of some gigantic vulture shot out of the sky. Both the kids were sound asleep. Lionel carried Jem in, then insisted on searching the house with Bree, nailing up laths across the shattered window in the parlour, while she combed the rooms again, suffering déjà vu.
"Had I not better spend the night?" Lionel asked, hesitating at the door. "I'd be happy to sit up and keep watch, you know."
She smiled, though it took a lot of effort. "Your wife will already be wondering where you are. No, you've done enough, more than enough for us. Don't worry. I'll take steps in the morning. I just want the kids to be able to have a good night's sleep in their own beds." He nodded, lips drawn in worry, and glanced around the foyer, its gleaming walnut panelling serene in the lamplight. Even the English sabre-slashes somehow grown homely and peaceful with age.
"Do you maybe have family, friends, in America?" he asked abruptly. "I mean, it might not be a bad idea to get right away for a bit, eh?"
"Yes," she said. "I was thinking that myself. Thanks, Lionel. Good night."
Chapter 42 All My Love. She was shaking, had been shaking ever since Lionel Mingus left. With a faint sense of abstraction, she held out her hand, fingers spread, and watched it vibrate like a tuning fork. Then, irritated, made a fist and smacked it hard into the palm of her other hand. Smacked it again and again, clenching her teeth in fury until she had to stop, gasping for breath, her palm tingling. "Okay," she said under her breath, teeth still clenched. "Okay." The red haze had lifted like a cloud, leaving a pile of cold, icy little thoughts under it. "We have to go."
"Where?"
"And when?"
"And the coldest of all,
what about Roger?"
She was sitting in the study, the wood panelling glowing softly in the candlelight. There was a perfectly good reading lamp as well as the ceiling fixture, but she'd lit the big candle instead. Roger liked to use that when he wrote late at night, writing down the songs and poems he'd memorized, sometimes with a goose quill. He said it helped him recall the words, bringing back an echo of the time where he'd learned them. The candle's smell of hot wax brought back an echo of him. If she closed her eyes, she could hear him humming low in his throat as he worked, stopping now and then to cough or clear his damaged throat. Her fingers rubbed softly over the wooden desk, summoning the touch of the rope scar on his throat, passing round to cut the back of his head, bury her fingers in the thick black warmth of his hair, bury her face in his chest. She was shaking again, this time with silent sobs. She curled her fist again, but this time just breathed until it stopped. "This will not do," she said out loud, sniffed deeply, and clicking on the light, she blew out the candle and reached for a sheet of paper and a ballpoint pen. Wiping the tears off her face with the back of her hand, she folded the letter carefully. Envelope? No. If anybody found this, an envelope wouldn't stop them. She turned the letter over and, sniffing, wrote "Roger" in her best parochial school penmanship. She groped in her pocket for Kleenex and blew her nose, feeling obscurely that she should do something more ceremonial with the letter. But other than putting it in the fireplace and touching a match to it so the north wind would carry it, as her parents had done with her childhood letters to Santa, nothing occurred to her. In her present state of mind, she found it comforting that Santa had always come through. She opened the big drawer and was groping at the back for the catch that released the secret hiding place when something else did occur to her. She slammed the big drawer shut and yanked open the wide, shallow one in the centre, which held pens and paper clips and rubber bands, and a lipstick left in the downstairs powder room by some random dinner guest. It was pink, but a dark pink, and it didn't matter that it clashed with her hair. She applied it hastily by feel, then pressed her lips carefully over the word "Roger." "I love you," she whispered, and touching the pink kiss with one fingertip, opened the big drawer again and pushed the spot that unlocked the hiding place. It wasn't a secret drawer, but a space built into the underside of the desk. A sliding panel let you reach up into a shallow hole about 6 inches by 8. When Roger discovered it, it had 3 stamps printed with the head of Queen Victoria in it. Unfortunately, all run-of-the-mill late Victorian postage, rather than a helpfully valuable one-penny black, and a wispy curl of a child's fine blonde hair faded with age, tied with white thread, and a tiny scrap of heather. They'd left the stamps there. Who knew? Maybe they would be valuable by the time another few generations inherited the desk. But she'd put the lock of hair between the pages of her Bible and said a small prayer for the child and his, her, parents, whenever she came across it. The letter fit easily into the heart of the old desk. A moment of panic. Should she have included locks of the kid's hair? No, she thought fiercely. Don't be morbid. Sentimental, yes. Morbid, no.
"Lord, let us all be together again," she whispered, pushing down the fear, and, closing her eyes, shut the panel with a little click. If she hadn't opened her eyes right as she withdrew her hand, she'd never have seen it. Just the edge of something hanging down at the back of the big drawer, barely visible. She reached up and found an envelope far back, attached to the underside of the desk with scotch tape. This had dried with age. Her earlier slamming of the drawer had probably loosened it. She turned the envelope over with a sense of something happening in a dream, and was dreamlike, not surprised to see the initials B.E.R. written on the yellowed envelope. Very slowly she opened it.
"Dearest Deadeye," she read,
and felt each tiny hair on her body rise, slow and silent, one at a time.
"Dearest Deadeye, you've just left me after our wonderful afternoon among the clay pigeons. My ears are still ringing. Whenever we shoot, I'm torn between immense pride in your ability, envy of it, and fear that you may someday need it. What a queer feeling it is writing this. I know that you'll eventually learn who and perhaps what you are, but I have no idea how you'll come to that knowledge. Am I about to reveal you to yourself, or will this be old news when you find it? And if we're both lucky, I may be able to tell you in person when you're a little older. And if we're very lucky, it will come to nothing. But I daren't risk your life in that hope, and you're not yet old enough that I could tell you. I'm sorry, sweetheart, that's terribly melodramatic. And the last thing I want to do is alarm you. I have all the confidence in the world in you. But I am your father, and thus pray to the fears that afflict all parents, that something dreadful and unpreventable will happen to one's child, and you powerless to protect her.
What the hell, Daddy?
She rubbed hard at the back of her neck to ease the prickling there.
Men who've lived through war usually don't talk about it, save to other soldiers. Men from my part of the service don't talk to anyone, and not only because of the Official Secrets Act. But silence eats at the soul. I had to talk to someone, and my old friend Reggie Wakefield became my confessor. That's the Reverend Reginald Wakefield, a Church of Scotland minister who lives in Inverness. If you're reading this letter, I'll very likely be dead. If Reggie is still alive and you are of age, go to see him. He has my permission to tell you anything he knows at that point.
Of age?
Hastily, she tried to calculate when this had been written. Clay pigeons, Sherman's, the shooting range where he taught her to use a shotgun. The shotgun had been a present for her 15th birthday, and her father had died soon after her 17th birthday. The service has nothing directly to do with this. Don't go looking in that direction for information. I mention it only because that's where I learned what a conspiracy looks like. I also met a great many people in the war, many of them in high places, and many of them strange. The two overlap more often than one might wish. Why is this so hard to say? If I am dead, your mother may have told you already the story of your birth. She promised me that she would never speak of it so long as I lived, and I'm sure she hasn't. If I'm dead, though, she might. Forgive me, darling. It's hard to say because I love your mother and I love you. And you are my daughter forever. But you were sired by another man. All right, that's out. Seeing it in black and white, my impulse is to rip this paper to bits and burn them. But I won't. You have to know. Shortly after the war ended, your mother and I came to Scotland. Something of a second honeymoon. She went out one afternoon to pick flowers, and never came back. I searched. Everyone searched for months, but there was no sign. And eventually the police stopped. Well, in fact, they didn't stop suspecting me of murdering her, damn them, but they grew tired of harassing me. I'd begun to put my life back together, made up my mind to move on, perhaps leave Britain. And then Claire came back. 3 years after her disappearance, she showed up in the Highlands, filthy, starved, battered, and pregnant. Pregnant, she said, by a Jacobite Highlander from 1743 named James Fraser. I won't go into all that was said between us. It was a long time ago, and it doesn't matter. Save for the fact that if your mother was telling the truth, and did indeed travel back in time, then you may have the ability to do it too. I hope you don't. But if you should, Lord, I can't believe I'm writing this in all seriousness. But I look at you, darling, with the sun on your ruddy hair, and I see him. I can't deny that. Well, it took a long time, a very long time. But your mother never changed her story, and although we didn't speak about it after a while, it became obvious that she wasn't mentally deranged, which I had rather naturally assumed to be the case, initially. And I began to look for him. Now I must digress for a moment, forgive me. I think you won't have heard of the Brown Seer. Colourful as he was, if in fact he existed, he's not really known much beyond those circles with a taste for the more outlandish aspects of Scottish history. Reggie, though, is a man of immense curiosity, as well as immense learning, and was fascinated by the seer. One Kenneth Mackenzie, who lived in the 17th century, maybe, and who made a great number of prophecies about this and that, sometimes at the behest of the Earl of Seaforth. Naturally, the only prophecies mentioned in connection with this man are the ones that appeared to come true. He predicted, for instance, that when there were 5 bridges over the River Ness, the world would fall into chaos. In August of 1939, the 5th bridge over the Ness was opened, and in September, Hitler invaded Poland. Quite enough chaos for anyone. The seer came to a sticky end, as prophets often do. Do please remember that, darling, will you? Burnt to death in a spiked barrel of tar at the instigation of Lady Seaforth, to whom he had unwisely prophesied that her husband was having affairs with various ladies while away in Paris. That one was likely true, in my opinion. Amongst his lesser-known prophecies, though, was one called the Fraser Prophecy. There isn't a great deal known about this, and what there is rambling and vague, as prophecies usually are, the Old Testament notwithstanding. The only relevant bit, I think, is this. The last of Lovett's line will rule Scotland. Pause, if you will, now, dear, and look at the paper I'm enclosing with this letter. Fumbling and clumsy with shock, she dropped the sheets altogether and had to retrieve them from the floor. It was easy to tell which paper he meant. The paper was flimsier, a photocopy of a handwritten chart, some sort of family tree, the writing not her father's. Yes, well, this bit of disturbing information came into my hands from Reggie, who'd had it from the wife of a fellow named Stuart Lachlan. Lachlan had died suddenly, and as his widow was clearing out his desk, she found this and decided to pass it on to Reggie, knowing that he and Lachlan had shared an interest in history and in the Lovett family, they being local to Inverness. The clan seat is in Bewley. Reggie, of course, recognised the names. You likely know nothing about the Scottish aristocracy, but I knew Simon Lovett, Lord Lovett, that is, in the war. He was commandos, then special forces. We weren't close friends, but knew each other casually in the way of business, you might say.
"Whose business?" she said aloud, suspicious. "His or yours?"
She could just see her father's face with the hidden smile in the corner of his mouth, keeping something back but letting you know it was there. The Frasers of Lovett have a fairly straightforward line of descent until we come to Old Simon. Well, they're all called Simon. The one they call the Old Fox, who was executed for treason after the Jacobite Rebellion, the 45, they call it. There's quite a bit about him in my book on the Jacobites. Don't know if you'll ever read that, but it's there, should you feel curious.
"Should I feel curious?" she muttered.
"Huh." Brianna sensed a definite, if muted, note of accusation there, and pressed her lips together, as much annoyed at herself for not having read her father's books yet, as at him for mentioning it. Simon was one of the more colourful Frasers in assorted ways. He had three wives, but was not famous for fidelity. He did have a few legitimate children, and God knows how many illegitimate ones, though two illegitimate sons were acknowledged. But his heir was young Simon, known as the Young Fox. Young Simon survived the rising, though attainted and stripped of his property. He eventually got most of it back through the courts, but the struggle took him most of a long life. And while he married, he did so at a very advanced age and had no children. His younger brother Archibald inherited, but then died childless as well. So Archibald was the last of Lovett's line. There's a direct line of descent between him and the Fraser of Lovett, who would have been concurrent with the Bran Seer, but clearly he wasn't the Scottish ruler foreseen. You see the chart, though. Whoever made it has listed the two illegitimate sons as well as young Simon and his brother, Alexander and Brian, born to different mothers. Alexander entered the priesthood and became the abbot of a monastery in France. No known children, but Brian. She tasted bile and thought she might throw up. But Brian. She closed her eyes in reflex, but it didn't matter. The chart was burned on the inside of her eyelids. Simon Lovett, the old fox, had three sons. Alexander, bastard. Simon Lovett, young fox, married unknown. Brian, bastard, born 1691, died 1740, married Ellen Mackenzie, born 1691, died 1729. One son, James Alexander, born 1721, married Claire Elizabeth Beecham, born 1918, who was married to Frank Randall. James Alexander and Claire Elizabeth had one daughter, Brianna Ellen Randall, Fraser, born 1948. She stood up, pushing back the chair with a squeak, and lurched out into the hallway, heart thundering in her ears. Swallowing repeatedly, she went to the lobby and got the shotgun from its place behind the coat rack. She felt a little better with it in hand. It isn't right. She hadn't realized that she'd spoken aloud. Her own voice startled her. It's not right, she repeated in a low, fierce voice. They left people out. What about Aunt Jenny? She had six kids. What about them? She was stomping down the hallway, gun in hand, swinging the barrel from side to side, as though she expected Rob Cameron, or somebody, and the thought made her shudder, to jump out of the parlour or the kitchen or come sliding down the banister. That thought made her look up the stairs. She'd left all the lights on when she came down from tucking in the kids, but the landing was empty, and no noise came from above. A little calmer, she searched the ground floor carefully, testing every door and window, and the priest's hole, whose empty blackness gaped mockingly up at her. Jem and Mandy were all right. She knew they were. But she still went upstairs, soft-footed, and stood by their beds for a long time, watching the pale glow of the snow-white nightlight on their faces. The long case clock in the hall below struck the hour, and then a single bong. She drew a deep breath and went down to finish reading her father's letter. The current line of Fraser of Lovett is descended from a collateral branch. Presumably the Fraser prophecy isn't referring to one of them, though there are plenty of heirs in that line. I don't know who drew this chart, but I do intend to find out. This letter is in case I don't. In case of a number of things. One of those things being the possibility that your mother's story is true. I still have difficulty believing it when I wake in the morning beside her and everything is so normal. But late at night, when I'm alone with the documents, well, why not admit it? I found the record of their marriage, James Alexander Malcolm Mackenzie Fraser and Claire Elizabeth Beecham. I'm not sure whether to be grateful or outraged that she didn't marry him using my name. Forgive me, I'm rambling. It's hard to keep emotion out of it, but I'll try. The essence of what I'm saying is this. If you can indeed go back in time, and possibly return, you are a person of very great interest to a number of people, for assorted reasons. Should anyone in the more shadowed realm of government be halfway convinced that you are what you may be, you would be watched, possibly approached. In earlier centuries, the British government pressed men into service. They still do, if less obviously. That's a very remote contingency, but it is a real one. I must mention it. There are private parties who would also have a deep interest in you for this reason. And evidently there is someone who has spotted you and is watching. The chart showing your line of descent, with dates, indicates that much. It also suggests that this person's or person's interest may be a concern with the Fraser prophecy. What could be more intriguing to that sort of person than the prospect of someone who is the last of Lovett's line, and is also a time traveller? These sorts of people, I know them well, invariably believe in mystic powers of all sorts. Nothing would draw them more powerfully than the conviction that you hold such power. Such people are usually harmless, but they can be very dangerous indeed. If I find whoever drew this chart, I will question them and do my best to neutralize any possible threat to you. But as I say, I know the look of a conspiracy. Nutters of this sort thrive in company. I might miss one. Neutralize them, she murmured, the chill in her hands spreading through her arms and chest, crystallizing around her heart. She had no doubt at all what he'd meant by that, the bland matter-of-factness of the term notwithstanding. And had he found him? Them? Don't, I repeat, don't go anywhere near the service or anyone connected with it. At best, they'd think you insane. But if you are indeed what you may be, the last people who should ever know it are the funny buggers, as we used to be known during the war. And if worse should come to worst, and you can do it, then the past may be your best avenue of escape. I have no idea how it works. Neither does your mother, or at least she says so. I hope I may have given you a few tools to help, if that should be necessary. And there's him. Your mother said that Fraser sent her back to me, knowing that I would protect her and you. She thought that he died immediately afterward. He did not. I looked for him, and I found him. And, like him, perhaps I send you back knowing, as he knew of me, that he will protect you with his life. I will love you forever, Brianna, and I know whose child you truly are. With all my love, Dad. Chapter 43. Apparition. The Lochaber district, according to the North of Scotland Hydroelectric Board, as interpreted by Brianna, is a high glaciated landscape.
That means it goes up and down a lot, Roger explained to Buck as they fought their way through what he thought was part of the Lochiel Forest, looking for the edge of Loch Lochy.
You don't see?
Buck glanced bleakly over his shoulder at the distant hump of Ben Nevis, then back at Roger.
I'd not noticed.
Cheer up, it's all downhill for a bit now, and the midges are all dead with the cold. Count your blessings.
Roger felt unaccountably cheerful this morning, perhaps only because the walking was downhill, after a strenuous week of combing the Cameron clan lands, a bewildering network of corries, tarns, moraines and monroes, those deceptive summits with their gently rounded tops and their unspeakable slopes. Thank God no one lived on top of them. Perhaps also because While they hadn't found Jem or any trace of him, it was progress of a sort. The Camerons, on the whole, had been hospitable after the initial surprise, and they'd had the luck to find a taxman of Lochiel, the clan chieftain who'd sent a man to Tor Castle for them. Word had come back a day later. No word of a stranger matching Rob Cameron's description. Though, in fact, Rob looked like half the people Roger had met in the last few days. Or Jem's. He being a lot more noticeable. They'd worked their way back along the shores of Loch Arkeg, the fastest way for someone to travel from the Great Glen if heading for the ocean. But no word of a boat, stolen or hired, and Roger began to feel that Cameron had not, after all, sought refuge or help among his ancient clan. A relief on the whole.
Blessings, is it?
Buck rubbed a hand over his face. Neither of them had shaved in a week, and he looked as red-eyed and grubby as Roger felt. He scratched his jaw consideringly.
Oh, well. A fox took a shit next to me last night, but I didn't step in it this morning. I suppose that'll do for a start.
The next day and night dampened Roger's mood of optimism somewhat. It rained incessantly, and they spent the night under heaps of half-dry bracken on the edge of a black tarn, emerging at dawn, chilled and frowsty, to the shrieks of plovers and killdeer. He hesitated momentarily as they rode past the place where they might turn toward Cranesmuir. He wanted badly to talk again with Dr. McEwen. His hand found his throat, thumb stroking the scar.
Maybe, the healer had said. Just maybe.
But McEwen couldn't aid them in looking for Jem. That visit would have to wait. Still, he felt his heart rise as they came over the pass and saw Lallybroch below. It was bittersweet, coming home to a home that was not his and might never be again. But it promised refuge and succour, if only temporarily. And it promised hope. At least in these last few minutes before they reached the door.
Och, it's you.
It was Jenny Fraser who opened the door, her look of wariness changing to one of pleased welcome. Roger heard Buck behind him making a small humming noise of approval at sight of her, and despite his determination not to hope too much, Roger felt his own spirits rise.
And this will be your kinsman?
She curtsied to Buck.
Welcome to you, sir. Come, Ben. I'll call Taggy to mind the horses.
She turned in a flicker of white apron and petticoats, beckoning them to follow.
Da's in the speaker ward, she called over her shoulder as she headed for the kitchen. He's something for you.
Mr. Mackenzie, and this would be also Mr. Mackenzie, aye?
Brian Fraser came out of the study, smiling, and offered Buck his hand. Roger could see him looking Buck over with close attention, a slight frown between his dark brows. Not disapproval. Puzzlement, as though he knew Buck from somewhere and was trying to think where. Roger knew exactly where, and felt again that peculiar quiver he'd felt on meeting Dougal Mackenzie. The resemblance between father and son was by no means instantly striking. Their colouring was very different. And Roger thought most of Buck's features came from his mother. But there was a fugitive similarity, nonetheless. Something in their manner. Men cocksure of their charm, and no less charming for knowing it. Buck was smiling, making commonplace courtesies, complimenting the house and its estate. The puzzlement faded from Brian's eyes, and he invited them to sit, calling down the hall to the kitchen for someone to bring them a bite and a dram.
"Well, then," Brian said, pulling out the chair from behind his desk in order to sit with them. "As you have now got the lad with you, I see he's not found yet. Have you heard any news of him, though?"
He looked from Buck to Roger, worried but hopeful.
"No,"
Roger said, and cleared his throat.
"Not a word. But your daughter said that you might have heard something."
Fraser's face changed at once, lighting a little.
"Well, it's nae so much heard anything, but—"
He rose and went to rummage in the desk, still talking.
A captain from the garrison came by here 2 or 3 days ago. We a small party of soldiers. The new man in charge... What was his name, Jenny? For Jenny had come in with a tray. This holding a teapot, cups, a small bottle of whiskey, and a plate of cake. The smell made Roger's stomach rumble.
Who? Oh, the new redcoat captain. Randall, he said. Jonathan Randall?
Her colour rose a little, and her father smiled to see it. Roger felt the smile freeze on his own face.
Aye, he took to you, lass. Wouldn't have been surprised if he came back one of these days.
Precious little good it will do him if he does, Jenny snapped. Have you lost that thing, Aha?
No, no, I'm sure I put...
Brian's voice trailed off as he scrabbled in the drawer.
Oh. Aye.
He coughed, hand in the drawer, and through his shock, Roger realized what the trouble was. The desk had a secret compartment. Evidently, Brian had put the thing, whatever it was, in the hiding place, and was now wondering how to get it out again without revealing the secret to his visitors. Roger rose to his feet.
"Will you pardon me, mistress?" he asked, bowing to Jenny. "I'd forgot something in my saddlebag. Come with me, aye?" he added to Buck. "It's maybe in with your things."
Jenny looked surprised, but nodded, and Roger blundered out, Buck making little grunts of annoyance at his heels.
"What the devil's wrong with you?" Buck said the minute they were out the door. "You went as white as a sheet in there, and you still look like a fish that's been dead a week." "I feel like one," Roger said tersely. "I know Captain Randall. Or rather, I know a lot of things about him. Leave it that he's the last person I'd want to have any knowledge of Jem."
"Oh." Buck's face went blank, then firmed.
"Aye, well, we'll see what it is he brought, and then we'll go and have it out with him if we think he might have the lad." "What is it he brought?"
Roger fought back all the horrible things that phrase conjured. Jem's ear, a finger, a lock of his hair. Because if it had been anything like that, surely the Frasers wouldn't be calm about it. But if Randall had bought some hideous token in a box...
"Why, though?"
Buck was frowning, plainly trying to read Roger's expression, which, judging from Buck's own, must be appalling.
"Why would this man mean you and the lad ill? He's never met you, has he?"
"That," Roger said, choking down his feelings, "is an excellent question. But the man is... Do you know what a sadist is?"
"No, but it's plainly something you dinna want close to your wain. Here, sir, we'll be taking those in, thank you kindly."
They'd come right round the house by now, and MacTaggart, the hired man, was coming down the path from the stable, their saddlebags in either hand. MacTaggart looked surprised, but surrendered the heavy bags gladly and went back to his work.
"I ken you just wanted to get us out of there so to give your man a bit of privacy to work the secret drawer," Buck remarked, "and he kens that fine. Do we need to take in something, though?" "How do you know about..."
Buck grinned at him, and Roger dismissed the question with an irritable gesture.
"Yes, we'll give Miss Fraser the cheese I bought yesterday." "Ah, Mrs. Jenny."
Buck made the humming noise again.
"I wouldn't blame Captain Randall. That skin and those bubs come to that. Shut up! Right this minute!"
Buck did, shocked out of his docularity.
"What?"
he said in quite a different tone.
"What is it?"
Roger unclenched his fist with an effort.
"It's a bloody long story. I haven't time to tell it to you now, but it's something I know from the other end, from my time. In a year or so, Randall's coming back here. He's going to do something terrible. And God help me, I don't think I can stop it." "Something terrible?"
Buck repeated slowly. His eyes were boring into Roger's own, dark as serpentine.
"To that bonny wee lass. And you think you can't stop it? Why, man, how can you..." "Just shut up,"
Roger repeated doggedly.
"We'll talk about it later, eh?"
Buck puffed out his cheeks, still staring at Roger, then blew out his breath with a sound of disgust and shook his head. But he picked up his saddlebag and followed without further argument. The cheese, a thing the size of Roger's outstretched hand, wrapped in fading leaves, was received with pleasure and taken off to the kitchen, leaving Roger and Buck alone once more with Brian Fraser. Fraser had regained his own composure, and picking up a tiny cloth-wrapped parcel from his desk, put it gently in Roger's hand.
Too light to be a finger.
Captain Randall said that Captain Buncombe sent word out with all the patrols, and one of them came across this wee bobby and sent it back to Fort William. None of them ever saw such a thing before, but because of the name they were thinking it might have to do with your lad.
The name.
Roger untied the cord, and the cloth fell open. For an instant, he didn't know what the hell he was seeing. He picked it up. It was light as a feather, dangling from his fingers. Two discs, made of something like pressed cardboard, threaded onto a bit of light-woven cord. One round, coloured red. The other was green. And octagonal.
Oh, Jesus, he said. Oh, Christ Jesus.
J.W. Mackenzie was printed on both discs, along with a number and two letters. He turned the red disc gently over with a shaking fingertip and read what he already knew was stamped there. R.A.F. He was holding the dog tags of a Royal Air Force flyer, circa World War II. Chapter 44 Amphisbina.
You canna be sure those things name your father,
Buck nodded at the dog tags, their cords still wrapped round Roger's hand, the tiny discs themselves folded tight in his palm.
How many Mackenzies are there, for God's sake?
Lots.
Roger sat down on a big lichen-covered boulder. They were at the top of the hill that rose behind Lallybroch. The broch itself stood on the slope just below them, its conical roof a broad black wall of slates.
But not so bloody many who flew for the Royal Air Force in World War II. And even fewer who disappeared without a trace. As for those, who might be time travellers.
Roger couldn't remember what he'd said when he saw the dog tags, or what Brian Fraser had said to him. When he'd started to notice things again, he was sitting in Brian's big wheel-backed chair with a stoneware mug of hot tea cupped between his hands, and the entire household crammed into the doorway, regarding him with looks ranging from compassion to curiosity. Buck was squatting in front of him, frowning in what might have been concern, or simply curiosity.
Sorry,
Roger had said, cleared his throat, and set the tea undrunk on the desk. His hands throbbed from the heat of the cup.
Rather a shock. Thank you.
Is it something to do with your wee boy, then? Jenny Fraser had asked, deep blue eyes dark with concern.
I think so, yes.
He'd got his wits back now and rose stiffly, nodding to Brian.
Thank you, sir. I can't thank you enough for all you've done for me, for us. I need to think a bit what's to do now, if you'll excuse me, Mistress Fraser.
Jenny nodded, not taking her eyes from his face, but shooing the maids and the cook away from the door so he could pass through it. Buck had followed him, murmuring reassuring things to the multitude, and come along with him, not speaking, until they reached the solitude of the craggy hilltop, where Roger had explained just what the dog tags were and to whom they had belonged.
Why two?
Buck asked, reaching out a tentative finger to touch the tags.
And why are they different colours?
Two, in case one was destroyed by whatever killed you,
Roger said, taking a deep breath.
The colours. They're made of pressed cardboard treated with different chemicals. Substances, I mean. One resists water, and the other resists fire. But I couldn't tell you which is which.
Speaking of technicalities made it just barely possible to speak. Buck, with unaccustomed delicacy, was waiting for Roger to bring up the unspeakable. How did the tags turn up here? And when, and under what circumstances had they become detached from J, Jeremiah, W, Walter, Mackenzie, Roman Catholic, serial number 44839761RAF?
Claire, my mother-in-law. I told you about her, did I not?
A bit, aye. A seer, was she?
Roger laughed shortly.
Aye, like I am. Like you are.
Easy to be a seer, if what you see has already happened.
What's already happened, he thought.
Oh, God, he said out loud, and curled over, pressing the fists that held the dog tags hard against his forehead.
All right there?
Buck asked after a moment. Roger straightened up with a deep breath.
Know the expression, damned if you do, damned if you don't?
No, though I wouldn't think it was one a minister would use.
Buck's mouth twitched into a half-smile.
Are you not dedicated to the notion that there's always one sure way out of damnation?
A minister. Aye.
Roger breathed deep again. There was a lot of oxygen on a Scottish hilltop, but somehow there didn't seem quite enough just this minute.
I'm not sure that religion was constructed with time travellers in mind.
Buck's brows rose at that.
Constructed?
He echoed, surprised.
Who builds God?
That actually made Roger laugh, which made him feel a little better, if only momentarily.
We all do,
he said dryly.
If God makes man in his image, we all return the favour.
Mm-hmm.
Buck thought that one over, then nodded slowly.
Wouldn't just say you're wrong about that, but God's there, nonetheless, whether we ken quite what he is or not, isn't he?
Yeah.
Roger wiped his knuckles under his nose, which had begun to run with the cold wind.
Ever hear of St. Teresa of Avila?
No.
Buck gave him a look.
Nor have I heard of a Protestant minister who has to do with saints.
I take advice where I can get it. But St. Teresa once remarked to God, if this is how you treat your friends, no wonder you have so few of them. God's got his own ways.
Buck smiled. It was one of his rare, unwary smiles, and it heartened Roger enough to try to come to grips with the situation.
Well, Claire, my mother-in-law, she told Brianna and me a good bit about the things that happened when she went through the stones in 1743, and about things that had happened before that. Things about Captain Randall.
And in sentences as brief and unemotional as he could make them, he told the story. Randall's raid on Lallybroch while Brian Fraser was away, his attack on Jenny Murray, and how Jamie Fraser, newly returned from Paris and wondering what to do with his life, had fought for his home and his sister's honour, been arrested and taken to Fort William, where he had been flogged nearly to death.
Twice,
Roger said, pausing for air. He swallowed.
Second time. Brian was there. He thought Jamie was dead, and he had a stroke, an apoplexy, on the spot. He died.
He swallowed again.
Will die.
Jesus, Mary and Bride.
Buck crossed himself. His face had gone pale.
Your man in the house? He'll be dead in a year or two?
Yes.
Roger looked down at Lallybroch, pale and peaceful as the sheep that browsed its pastures.
And there's more. What happened later? Just before the rising?
Buck raised a hand.
I say that's more than enough. I say we go down to Fort William and do for the wicked bugger now. Preemptive action, you might say.
That's a legal term, he explained with an air of kindly condescension.
An appealing notion, Roger said dryly. But if we did, what would happen 4 years from now?
Buck frowned, not comprehending.
When Claire came through the stones in 1743,
she met,
will meet, Jamie Fraser, an outlaw with a price on his head, coming home from France. But if what happened with Captain Randall doesn't happen, Jamie won't be there. And if he isn't...
Oh.
The frown grew deeper, comprehension dawning.
Oh, aye, I see. No Jamie, no Brianna.
No Jem or Mandy,
Roger finished.
Exactly.
Oh, God.
Buck bent his head and massaged the flesh between his brows with two fingers.
Damned if you do, damned if you don't, did you say? Enough to make your head spin like a top.
Yes, it is. But I have to do something nonetheless.
He rubbed a thumb gently over the dog tag's surfaces.
I'm going down to Fort William to talk to Captain Randall. I have to know where these came from.
Buck looked squiggle-eyed at the tags, lips pressed together.
Do you think you're lads with your father somehow?
No.
That particular thought hadn't occurred to Roger, and it shook him for a moment. He shrugged it away, though.
No,
he repeated more firmly.
I'm beginning to think that maybe... Maybe Jem's not here at all.
The statement hung there in the air, revolving slowly. He glanced at Buck, who seemed to be glowering at it.
Why not?
His kinsman asked abruptly.
A, because we've found no hint of him. And B, because now there's these.
He raised the tags, the light cardboard discs lifting in the breeze.
You sound like your wife,
Buck said half amused.
She does that, eh? Laying things out, A, B, C and all.
That's how Brianna's mind works,
Roger said, feeling a brief surge of affection for her.
She's very logical. And if I'm right, and Jem's not here, where is he? Has he gone to another time, or did he not travel at all?
He thought. As though the word logical had triggered it, a whole array of horrifying possibilities opened out before him.
Well, I'm thinking. We were both concentrating on the name Jeremiah when we came through, aye?
Aye, we were.
Well?
He twirled the cord between his fingers, making the discs spin slowly.
What if we got the wrong Jeremiah? That was my father's name, too. And if Rob Cameron didn't take Jem through the stones...
Why would he not?
Buck interrupted sharply. He transferred the glower from the discs to Roger.
His truck was there at Craignadoon. He wasn't.
Plainly he wanted us to think he'd gone through. As to why?
He choked on the thought. Before he could clear his throat, Buck finished it for him.
To get us away so he'd have your missus to himself.
His face darkened with anger, part of it aimed at Roger.
I told her yon man had a hot eye for her.
Maybe he does,
he said shortly.
But think, aye, beyond whatever he may have had in mind with regard to Brianna.
The mere words conjured up pictures that made the blood shoot up into his head.
Whatever he had in mind,
he repeated, as calmly as he could.
He likely also wanted to see whether it was true. About the stones. About whether we or anyone really could go through. Seeing's believing, after all.
Buck blew out his cheeks, considering.
You think he was there, maybe? Watching to see if we disappeared?
Roger shrugged, momentarily unable to speak for the thoughts clotting his brain. Buck's fists were clenched on his knees. He looked down at the house, then behind him at the rising mountains, and Roger knew exactly what he was thinking. He cleared his throat with a hacking growl.
We've been gone for 2 weeks, Roger said. If he meant Brianna harm, he'd have tried... Jesus, if he... No. She'll not have let him harm her or the kids.
he went on as steadily as he could.
If he tried anything, he'll either be in jail or buried under the broch.
He lifted his chin toward the tower below, and Buck snorted in reluctant amusement.
So then, I want to rush straight back to Craignadoon too. But think, man, we ken Cameron went to the stones after he took Jem. Would he not make Jem touch them to see? And if he did, what if Cameron can't travel, but Jem did, to get away from him?
Mm-hmm. Buck thought that one over and gave a reluctant nod.
So you're maybe thinking that if the lad was scared of Cameron and popped through accidental, he maybe wouldn't try to come straight back?
He maybe couldn't.
Roger was dry-mouthed and swallowed hard to generate enough saliva to speak.
Didn't have a gemstone, and even with one.
He nodded at Buck.
Ken, what happened to you, even with one? It does get worse each time. Jimmy might have been too scared to try. And he might have tried, not made it, and now he's lost for good. No, he thought.
Buck nodded.
So you think he's maybe with your da after all?
He sounded dubious in the extreme.
Roger couldn't bear sitting any longer. He stood up abruptly, thrusting the dog tags into the breast pocket of his coat.
I don't know, but this is the only solid bit of evidence we have. I have to go and see.
Chapter 45 The Cure of Souls.
You're out of your wee pink mind, you ken that, aye?
Roger looked at Buck in amazement.
Where the devil did you get that expression?
From your wife, Buck replied, who's a very bonny lass and a well-spoken one forby. And if you mean to get back to her bed one of these days, you'll think better of what you mean to do.
I've thought, Roger said briefly, and I'm doing it.
The entrance to Fort William looked much as it had when he'd come here with Brian Fraser nearly 2 weeks earlier. But this time, with only a few people hastening in, shawls over their heads, and hats pulled down against the rain. The fort itself now seemed to have a sinister aspect, the grey stones bleak and streaked black with wet. Buck reined up, grimacing as the horse shook its head and sprayed him with drops from its soaking mane.
Aye, fine. I'm no going in there. If we have to kill him, it's best if he doesn't ken me so I can get behind him. I'll wait at yonder tavern.
He lifted his chin, indicating an establishment called the Pear Tree, a few hundred feet down the road from the fort, then kicked his horse into motion. 10 feet on, he turned and called over his shoulder,
1 hour. If you're not with me by then, I'm coming in after you.
Roger smiled, despite his apprehension. He waved briefly to Buck and swung off his horse.
Bless me, Lord, he prayed. Help me to do the right thing. For everyone, including Buck. And him.
He hadn't actually stopped praying at any time since Jem had disappeared, though most of it was just the frantic, reflexive,
Dear Lord, let it be all right,
of everyone facing crisis. Over time, either the crisis or the petitioner wears down, and prayer either ceases or the person praying starts to listen. He knew that, and he was listening, but he was still taken aback to get an answer. He had enough experience in the business of prayer to recognize an answer when it showed up, though, however unwelcome. And the pointed reminder, arriving as a random thought in the middle of their mud-spattered, rain-sodden journey, that Jack Randall's soul was in as much danger as Brian Fraser's life, was damned unwelcome.
Well, then, Buck had said, brightening under the soggy brim of his hat when Roger had shared his disturbance at this insight. All the more reason to kill him now. Save yon Fraser's, and keep the wicked wee sod from going to hell. If he hasn't done something already, as would send him there,
he'd added as an afterthought.
Two birds wi' one stone, aye?
Roger had squelched along for a moment before replying.
Out of sheer curiosity.
Were you a solicitor or a barrister when you did law?
Solicitor, why?
No wonder you failed at it. All your talents lie in the other direction. Can you not have a conversation without arguing?
Not with you,
Buck had said pointedly, and kicked his horse into a trot, sending up thumping clods of mud in his wake. Roger gave his name and asked the army clerk if he might have a word with Captain Randall, then stood by the peat fire, shaking off as much water as he could before the man came back to lead him to Randall's office. To his surprise, it was the same office where he and Brian Fraser had had their audience with Captain Buncombe almost 2 weeks before. Randall was seated behind the desk, quill in hand, but looked up with a courteous expression at Roger's entrance and half rose with a small bow.
Your servant, sir. Mr. Mackenzie, is that right? You've come from Lallybroch, I collect.
You're most obedient, sir,
Roger replied, adjusting his accent back to his normal Scots-tinged Oxbridge.
Mr. Brian Fraser was good enough to give me the object that you brought. I wanted both to thank you for your kind assistance and to ask whether you might be able to tell me where the object was discovered.
He knew about the banality of evil. Human monsters came in human shapes. Even so, he was surprised. Randall was a handsome man, rather elegant in bearing, with a lively, interested expression, a humorous curve to his mouth, and warm, dark eyes.
Well, he is human, and perhaps he's not a monster yet, he thought.
One of my messengers brought it in, Randall replied,
wiping his quill and dropping it into a stoneware jar full of such objects.
My predecessor, Captain Buncombe, had sent dispatches to Fort George and Fort Augustus about your son. I am very sorry for your situation, he added, rather formally. A patrol from Riven Barracks had brought the ornament in. I'm afraid I don't know where they discovered it, but perhaps the messenger who brought it from Riven does. I'll send for him.
Randall went to the door and spoke to the sentry outside. Coming back, he paused to open a cupboard, which revealed a wig stand, a powdering shaker, a pair of hairbrushes, a looking glass, and a small tray with a cut glass decanter and glasses.
Allow me to offer you refreshment, sir.
Randall poured a cautious inch into each glass and offered one to Roger. He picked up his own, his nostrils flaring slightly at the scent of the whisky.
The nectar of the country, I'm given to understand, he said with a wry smile. I am told I must develop a taste for it.
He took a wary sip, looking as though he expected imminent death to result.
If I might suggest, a bit of water mixed with it is customary,
Roger said, carefully keeping all trace of amusement out of his voice.
Some say it opens the flavour, makes it smoother.
Oh, really?
Randall put down his glass, looking relieved.
That seems sensible. The stuff tastes as though it's flammable. Saunders! He shouted toward the door. Bring some water.
There was a slight pause, neither man knowing quite what to say next.
The, thing, Randall said. Might I see it again? It's quite remarkable. Is it a jewel of some kind? An ornament?
No, it's a sort of charm,
Roger said, fishing the dog tags out of his pocket. He felt an ache in his chest at thought of the small personal rituals that the flyers did. A lucky stone in the pocket, a special scarf, the name of a woman painted on the nose of a plane. Charms. Tiny bits of hopeful magic, protection against a vast sky filled with fire and death.
To preserve the soul.
In memory, at least.